I almost missed the record button. That was dangerous.
271 episodes, and I've never missed the record button once.
Never missed the record button. Stanislav, speaking of recording.
Mm-hmm.
What a setup.
Yeah, right? We call that a bridge mm-hmm. or something.
Segway.
A segue.
Layup.
Yeah. So you do not know what high-speed dubbing is.
For the 30th time, I do not.
I know. I just keep hitting this point. What about Dolby noise reduction?
You ever have a boombox with two cassette decks in it?
I have. So I've recorded cassettes off the radio, off of CDs from other cassettes. Like I've done all this, but I was doing it as a young lad. So I didn't know all the technical ins and outs that you boomer nerds were probably salivating over.
It's just a lot of these two cassette decks had the playback head set and they had the recording set. So it was you could turn on high speed dubbing on one so that it would record your cassette from one to the other at double speed or something like that. So if you knew
save time.
Yeah, if you knew exactly what playlist you wanted to make for somebody on a cassette, you didn't have to listen to the whole thing while it was dubbing.
Or you wanted to give all of your friends your sick album.
What's a cassette?
Yeah, right. Ooh.
Have you ever played a cassette, Devin?
I have, yes.
Oh, he has.
Come on, I'm not that young. Devin,
you're not that.
I'm considered
baby.
A boomer, okay?
Can I ask you guys, what's the weirdest collection of two albums that you had on a single cassette tape? Do you remember any of this?
Yes.
Okay, what did you have?
So one of my famous ones, I even I don't remember if I hand drew the art or if I photocopied the art or something like that, but I had NOFX, Punk and Drublic on the A side, and then Apollo 18 by They Might Be Giants on the B side.
Hmm.
They were both 44 minutes.
That's funny.
It was perfect. It was perfection.
I had a cassette that I listened to all the time in high school that was on the A side. It was Way to Blue, Nick Drake, which was a Nick Drake compilation of a bunch of the best songs that got kind of popular in the 90s before we got went back to his albums. And the B side was Aqualung by Jethro Tull.
That's a long record too. It was one of those 90 minute cassettes.
It was 100-minute cassettes, 120-minute cassette. Yeah.
I was weird. When I bought a Walkman, okay? I bought an Iowa Walkman, and it was 65 United States dollars, in 96, 95,
so which is $120 now.
Yes. Yeah, I bought a $120 Walkman, had an FM tuner. It also, but most importantly, it supported Dolby metal tapes
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. noise reduction for the finest in tape sound quality.
Wow.
Hello and welcome to episode 271 of The Dive Down, a Magic the Gathering podcast focused on the latest decks, trends, and strategies for the casual spike. My name is Stanislav here in Chicago, and with me on the line from Denver, Colorado, it's the one and only Shane Beeps.
Stanislav, it's tax day. It's tax day. Did you get your taxes in, or did your mom file you an extension?
My mother did not file me an extension, but I did submit my taxes by mail on Saturday.
My man.
I had my mother's you got to get your receipt, Stan. Get that tracking number. Whatever the cost.
What was the cost?
$6.
Ooh. Tracked? Insured?
I don't insure. I don't insure. Before I introduce Dave, I have good news. I just 2-0'd a Rakdos Vampire player because I had a match going during our cold open that I didn't want to stop because I knew you guys could go on and on about cassettes without really my involvement.
Amazing.
Also with us, the Godfather, Dave Harbarger.
Hey, it's your friend, Dave.
Hey, David.
How's it going?
Hey, Dave.
Are we going to introduce Devin? I don't think we introduced Devin. Hey, guess who else is here? It's Devin O'Donnell.
And joining us is Devin O'Donnell, a.k.a. Doomwake, who also paid his taxes.
Great.
I'm glad we're all following the law.
This is multiple tax openings we've had.
To an extent, you know.
We already talked about taxes last week or the week before.
I mean, this is how inflexible my old mind is becoming, David.
Yeah.
This is what's on my mind lately. It's been a blur of a few weeks.
Yeah, it's been
1 week.
A blur for a couple weeks. Yeah. Got my taxes filed today.
No. Oh, no. Absolutely not. That should be cut. It's brutally, brutally. We're gonna get it from two sides cut. There. The people who hate Bare Naked Ladies and the people who do that song in karaoke and can't believe that you just dishonored their cause so much.
I thought I was okay at that.
Yeah. I thought Shane was gonna do a song about heavy play. Because you could probably, you know, rhyme that in there, but
new card game accessories brand. Yeah. Improve your gameplay and your game day.
Randy, please don't listen to that. Whatever
Dave
you
can't
do.
Stop me. Dave can't stop me. If you want to hear what he's talking about, maybe check the outtake at the end of the episode. But it is a new card gaming accessories brand, new-ish. I mean, Heavy Play's been around the block. They're sponsoring events. They're sponsoring streamer pure moderate events. They're doing interviews on site. So the reason they're doing this, okay, is because they have playmats, deck boxes, card sleeve, dice boxes, enhanced ergonomics, mobility, and protection. And as we say, we are loyal users of Heavy Play products. When we were all together, I remember we all pulled those out of our backpacks and unfolded the playmats, which have magnets that allow you to snap them together.
Yeah, and I held mine up and said, the power of wind. And Stan was heart, I think. Devin, mm-hmm. Earth.
Yeah, I'm fire.
Shane, fire. I don't know.
Stan's definitely heart.
These magnets are so strong that they were creating artifact sounds in David's input feed on the podcast because his deck boxes were too close to the microphone.
Exactly. That is what
it
was.
Oh my gosh. So you can, the ABCs, attach, bundle, carry. Carry all of it in a single hand, easily slide it into whatever bag you're using, go from table to table, walk around. I saw people walking around with these things magnetized all together at the Chicago event. You can probably get them at your LGS if you're lucky. But I would prefer you go to heavyplay.com and you use the code thedivedown2024, which gets you 10% off of your first order. If you happen to go to any Magic live action, real life Magic event, and you see the Heavy Play folks there, tell them the Dive Down sent you. Stan, what are we doing? I mean, this on this week's show.
Yeah, I'm excited to tell you. This is an episode that I've been very looking forward to recording because I need help, you guys.
With what?
In our attempt.
Taxes?
No, taxes are tracked and sent, okay? In our attempt to fill that awkward week between spoilers and set release, we are recording on a Monday. We're going to focus on the upcoming RCQ season, which conveniently kicks off this weekend, Saturday, April 20th. A very normal day.
Mm-hmm.
It's Pioneer again. Just every other RCQ season is Pioneer. So I guess got to dust off my old cards from Ravnica Remastered. No, that's not what the set was called. Return to Ravnica? Yeah, Return to Ravnica. Yep. Onward. We're going to look at the Pioneer metagame going into the season and some of the possible upgrades from Outlaws of Thunder Junction that might shake up the format as well. But before that, we got some quick housekeeping. No new patrons. No new reviews.
Well, no, yes, a new review.
We found a new review?
Yes, we did.
I was looking. I couldn't find any.
It says, Undisputed Number One, my go-to source for all things mounted warfare. The team digs deep into real issues. Is it the mount or the rider that truly wins the war? My friends.
Wow. Mantis Rider.
Wesley, dude. Yeah, Wesley J. here. Via Apple Podcasts. Well, Wesley J. here has been around for a while. We thank you so much for your review, Wesley.
Wesley's based.
Yeah. Well, that was somebody who was paying attention to the details of like the one mini argument that we had on the show last week or 2 weeks ago about mounting. Or what is it? Is it called saddling? Why isn't the mechanic just called mounting? Do you guys think?
I think there's probably a good reason.
Okay.
I don't know what that would be though.
Okay. All right, so if you would like to leave a great review like Wesley, you can do it on Spotify, you can do it on iTunes or anywhere. We will find you. If you would like to support us like several people
we
do.
We will find you.
We will find you. If you leave us a review, if you just speak it into the ether, we will find you. If you would like to support us like several people do, go to patreon.com/thedivedown episode several. You can get into our chats and get, you know, get some swag from different layers of the Patreon. I guess they're called tiers. All right. I'm just freestyling this. I haven't done the promo in a while. If you would like to support us via not Patreon, you can go to our store at thedivedon.com/store. We did sell a hat a couple of weeks ago. And so the money is rolling in. If you would like to also support us, oh, look, Devin's got a button. You get a button if you join. That's true. You get many different badges.
Who gave you that button?
Shane.
Shane. Don't blame me.
Nice.
Is that Shane, I don't remember you submitting the paperwork for a free button to Devin.
Button requisition.
Button. I'll update the button. The button allocation spreadsheet.
Yeah. But if you would like to support us another way, you can go to manatraders.com and rent Magic online cards from Manatraders. Our code right now is thedivedown_K4L. The dive down is all one word. It's got an underscore and then it's K4L. That is for 10% off your first 2 months of rental cards. Those are all the ways that you can help us out.
That was beautiful, Dave.
Yes, and we appreciate those of you who have helped us all along.
Yeah. 271 episodes people have been helping us. Hard to believe.
And you know what? I still have countless questions about how to get better at Magic the Gathering tournaments. And I think that's what this episode's all about.
You and me both, Stan.
A topic that is near and dear to my heart. I've done episodes like this before. It's a tournament prep show. I think what makes this particular weekend unique is that I at least do not recall any instance where RCQ season kicks off at the same time as a set release. And
yeah, that's a tough one.
Possibly a new format altogether.
I'm sure it's happened, but I can't remember when, for what it's worth. And especially in a format that we watch, I don't remember really for sure.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there have been instances where a set has come out in the middle of RCQ season.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, I think this is kind of like, yeah, exactly. Or maybe Lord of the Rings during one of the modern seasons, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it's always RCQ season somewhere. It's just, yes. And sets always come out somewhere. So, you know, yeah. True. But yes, Stan, it is a slightly unique situation, as you were saying, because this set comes out literally the same day or is available for play really the same day as you in particular are going to an RCQ and many other people are, right?
Well, I don't know that others have RSVP'd like I have, but yes, I'm walking to my new neighborhood LGS.
Oh, I love it.
Ooh.
Literally down the street from me. I can't wait. I tried to stop by there today to buy some sleeves. Turns out they're closed on Mondays. Good for them.
They need a break.
Don't we all?
Take a break.
So even though OTJ officially enters paper play this weekend, let's get one thing straight. We probably don't actually have to worry about the week one RCQ season being overrun with Duelist of the Minds or whatever other cards
Slick
Devin
shot,
has,
trick shotter.
Has bought.
Okay, I mean, Devin, you've done the most RCQs of all of us by quite a large margin. Has that been your experience? Like, when, you know, have you rolled up? I know that, you know, we just said there haven't been too many that are this close, but like, you know, how quickly do you think the meta is changing at your RCQs?
I mean, it kind of depends. Stan kind of brought this question up in the Discord a little bit, and it really depends on the specific individuals that, you know, I mean, the people who have been playing a bunch of vampires, and I think for the most part, the metagame's not going to change that much. At least, like, you know, we said in the early weeks, it's going to be mostly the same. But it kind of depends if you've been, like, playtesting a lot with the new set with your friends or something, if you've been proxying up cards and you have an idea that you're really invested in and you know is good, and you have a good metagame call. Like, it's honestly the first week or two of a new set is probably the best time to bring that out, because a lot of people just aren't going to be prepared for the new cards yet, because 90% of the people going to these tournaments are just going to play stock vampires, stock Amalia, stock Phoenix, or whatever. So,
well, I also feel like it's important to acknowledge the discourse a little bit. Sourcing cards is just kind of hard nowadays.
It is a little more difficult than it used to be, I think. Yes.
Maybe I've rose-colored glasses, but I don't know.
I lucked out. My LGS just had four slick shots and four duels, and I was like, all right, cool. I'll just buy those. Those are the cards I need. So,
dang. But
my dad is sending me a box of Thunder Junction in the mail. I'm a 45-year-old man. My dad still sends me Magic cards sometimes.
David, you've been very well behaved since the last set release.
Yes, I've seen your report card. Here you go. Right.
I think it's also important to acknowledge that while, yes, maybe people are going to be trying their brews or, you know, looking to add like one or two new sideboard cards, something like that, information may not spread quickly enough for there to be an obvious new addition from OTJ into the Pioneer metagame on week one. It could happen. Like, there's lots of pre-releases. They're posting league results every week or every day now. But, you know, even if something truly broken is emerging, like, I guess this is my way of saying, like, I'm not too worried that people are going to, like, figure out what the new Tybalt combo is in Pioneer and have it ready to go on Saturday if they're not, like, actually able to buy singles yet, because it might be kind of hard with the current LGS landscape in America.
Yeah, I think the card that you're most likely to encounter from the new set in week one or week two is probably Slickshot Showoff, because that one is immediately powerful, and it's not that hard to build a deck around. Like, it's just play this and a bunch of cheap cards, so the decks kind of build themselves, and it's extremely powerful. So, if anything, that's what you're most likely to see, I think.
Yeah, it's also, as much as I love Prowessy decks, it's not that hard to play as well, so people will be willing to pick it up and try it in events like this, I think. And that's nothing but love for those decks, because that's the level I'm at. But
what's the risk in doing something like this, though? If you're the one who's trying to innovate, you see a card like Slickshot that reads powerful. We don't necessarily have a ton of data yet. And historically, there hasn't really been a pervasive prowess deck in Pioneer. Isn't there always a chance that this is not the card that makes that viable? Or maybe we're talking about people's other dream brews. Like, there's always a chance that you're going to try something new that's untested and suffer the consequences, right?
Oh, for sure. And I think the question that people might also ask themselves, right, is, you know, like, if you go back to what Devin was saying, which is, hey, if there are people who are like proxying cards and, you know, prepping with their friends and grinding some stuff out, I mean, those are the players that I want to play against anyway, because they're going to be more prepared than I am. But they have to ask themselves the question, like, is this better than the other aggressive decks we have in the format, right? And I say the aggressive decks like 15 times. So what I consider those is it Insol, Boros Heroic, and Boros Convoke, right? And so we'll talk about like actual win rates of those from Anil Yahi's data. But, you know, is an untested, potentially untested, like, you know, prowessy style deck immediately going to prove itself to be better than the established aggressive decks? And I mean, that's a question too. And do they do something different than what those aggressive decks are trying to do as well? So,
yeah, in the case of Slickshot specifically, the example that I want to kind of give is Heroic, because the Heroic deck plays a 2-mana 2/2 haste already, 10th District Legionnaire. And I think that Slickshot is basically just I'm not going to say strict because I don't like that word, but I think it is a significant upgrade to that card. But it plays well enough with the rest of the deck that you don't really have to change the deck fundamentally. You can just kind of make that swap and be confident that that is a good swap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think this kind of transitions to something I wonder a lot. I wonder about a lot whenever any new set comes out. And that's whether the focus should be on looking at upgrading existing decks, proven entities with possible new additions, like strict upgrades or maybe theoretical upgrades. Or is it better to try to like actually use your resources to break something and find like whatever that crazy new week one combo is before people figure out like why it's actually not good or how to beat it, etc.?
Probably not going to find that week one, like just being honest. And even as somebody who plays as much Magic as I do, I play Magic 6, 7, 8 hours a day, and I still have a hard time finding those even after 4 weeks. You know, they're just really hard to find.
Yeah, and I also think that with this set in particular, I don't know if there was anything that was identified as a very super game-breaking card, right? Like, there are certain sets where we know, oh, people are going to be trying this card. it with it. Or there are certain sets where we find out a week or two later, as in the case of Vein Ripper plus Sorin, that, oh, that actually is something that was a meme and is good. But I think in this particular set, I don't know if there's anything that's like a broken combo piece of some kind that's on anybody's radar right now. So I wouldn't expect it this week. And so I would expect people to be, if that happens, to be later. So most people, I think, will be focusing on what pieces can I take and put in the decks I already have, what seems like it's good against the decks that are already at the top of the meta, and then going from there.
Yeah. And because I think we are expecting the usual meta going into weekend one of RCQ season, part of me also wonders that like there may actually be more value in looking at innovated new sideboard cards for existing decks that maybe, you know, the existing decks and their players aren't prepared for, like a new approach to interaction. I don't have actual specific examples of this, but I feel like we identify lots of sideboard cards from the new sets, but we're not the ones that are always testing it.
Yeah, and it's a good thing you bring that up, Stan, because this set has a lot of them. Right. Yes. Now, we talk about Rest in Peace, that's already in Pioneer, but specifically the two that come to mind are High Noon and Torpor Orb. I think those are both going to have massive, massive impacts, specifically Torpor Orb against like Boros Convoke and things of that nature, and then High Noon against Lotus Field, Phoenix, all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of surprising to me how many good sideboard cards we actually have in this set.
Sweet. So I think one of the ways we can shape our conversation today as we prepare for this new season and week one of tournaments is to look at some of the most recent Pioneer data we've collected. And there have been a handful of really great sources of robust data with large sample sizes that indicate not only position within the format, but win rate across matchups. So what I've done is I've compiled Frank Karsten's most recent Pioneer metagame mentor, and not the one that he did, which was a Cool Decks Inc. article, but the one that was looking primarily at the winner's metagame and position of the most popular decks in the format. And I tried to cross-reference that against some of the matchup spread data that we get from sites like, I think it's mtgdecks.net, mtgdata.io. Who did you cite earlier?
So Anil Yahi,
Yeah,
who does a lot of analysis and then publishes it on Twitter.
And I also think that going into this RCQ season, we actually have like a wealth of really up-to-date data on the Pioneer format that not only can inform your decision in deck selection, but might also be really useful in figuring out like what to expect. Like, are people actually playing Rakdos Vampires over Rakdos Mid in large numbers? Spoiler alert. Yes. Or are we on, is it Drake's train or back on, is it Phoenix?
It's a Phoenix, actually, guys. Spoiler alert.
Surprise.
And so on. Yeah. So I want to go through some of these decks, looking at the numbers, trying to understand, like, when are things good? What's actually the tier one, tier two, and tier three of the meta that we need to be prepared for. And also look at some of Devin's most recent work in trying to either push boundaries with new technology from OTG or actually maybe cook up something brand new that could be competitive going into this brand new and unknown format.
Sweet.
Okay, so let's talk about what I consider the tier one in the format right now, which is, according to Frank, anything that is above 10% of the winner's metagame.
Okay. I was going to ask you, do you have, you know, what's your cutoff, Stan? Just kind of, these are the tiers that sort of made themselves?
Yeah, it's 10% and above. It's a really easy thing to cut because there's a huge cliff from over 10% to under 10%. And I also really like using Frank's data as the baseline here because he's weighting popularity with success.
Yes. I mean that's important to, you know, review. Like these numbers are not going to be like raw metagame percentage. I threw a few of those in from Anil Yahi's Twitter account that he shared this data on, like kind of what the actual representation is. But yeah, I think it's good to have like the sort of weighted metagame percentage that Frank provides.
And he's on WotC payroll. I think he just gets the best data.
That's actually the main reason that I go there is like, I like all these other people who are doing the Lord's work out here, but Frank does have, I think, whatever data is the most official for sure. So,
and according to Frank's data, the most good and popular deck right now appears to be Rakdos Vampires.
Okay. It's important to understand though, that it does not say this is the best deck. It says that with a weighted winner's meta, it is even higher than its natural metagame percentage because it's like, I mean, it's also extremely good, right? Like it's, I think Anil has it at like a 55.5% win rate, which is of course dang good, right? But I think that it's like, I do want to caution where it's like, okay, this is not like a 59% like crazy deck.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe like the way to frame it is not the best deck, but actually like the most popular deck or, you know, the deck to beat at the moment.
For what it's worth on the meta, I'm looking at the last 60 days and it shows 58%. So there might be just, I kind of changed the date range a little bit. So.
And this has been my experience actually playing online too. Like I'm running into vampires a lot. I feel like I'm running into vampires more than I ever ran into just Rakdos mid. Which is, you know, that was the evolution.
Vampires are just way cooler, Stan.
It's I think it's attractive to a few more people because it has a more aggressive plan in a way. Like it has this kind of combo. It's Splinter Twins, I guess is what I'm saying. And so people are more interested in it because of that.
I mean, I would love to play a mid-range deck that does not involve me, you know, slowly grinding my opponent out. If I can, you know, just slap down a gigantic vampire, I'm all for it.
I also thought it was noteworthy that according to mtgdecks.net, Vampires has very few bad matchups. And from the data I saw, it looks like it's just about good against everything except Rakzak, Amalia, and Greasefang.
Azorius Spirits was one I noticed from Anil's data. And I guess I'll also preface that Anil's data is like just over 2 months like since the release of MKM. So it's not as much data as you might think for some archetypes. Like some of the actual matchups are fairly low in sample size, but it does indicate that it's like 44.4% against spirits, which I think makes sense, right? Like you're putting pressure on removal, you're attacking in the air, you have enough interaction to maybe keep them on their toes, like just like their removal or counter spells.
The Niv-to-Light as well. I'm looking at Anil Yahi's stats and Niv-to-Light. It looks like it's 33% against only 12 matches, of course. But yeah, that one seems to be not a great matchup as well.
Interesting.
I don't want to be rude to like Niv-to-Light, but at what point is that considered like a real deck in Pioneer? Like, is this something that like has enough percentage? Maybe now. Maybe
it does. I think you should look at a little lower on Stan's list to see where it falls.
Yeah, it's down there.
Yeah.
It's not. It's in fifth.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Why?
It's a good deck.
I have
the same question, actually. We'll get
there.
I had the exact same question. But so, Shane, your shout out about Spirits is interesting because Spirits is also playing Catilda Dawnheart Martyr, which is a big flying beater that has protection from vampires, which I think helps to some extent.
Protection.
I have played this actual matchup. Spirits is one of the decks I was considering for the weekend. And between Spirits and is it in Soul, which are kind of my top two, I've ruled out Phoenix for personal reasons, which we'll get to in a bit.
Personal. Okay.
I've always hated those Phoenixes.
The way that a lot of decks are able to beat vampires, or the way I'm able to beat vampires sometimes, that I think maybe illustrates why Spirits appears to have a favorable matchup is that if you can almost force them into a one-to-one game where you're trading resources on your terms rather than them like using their removal spells and picking what they're disrupting, if you can kind of dictate that mid-range game, they run out of gas at a certain point and don't actually have a lot of tools to rebuild once they're hellbent.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a matchup I would enjoy playing. I just want to, like, you know, it's the kind of pressure I want to put on my, you know, ground and pound, and, you know, with And you do have the opportunity to potentially, you know, remove their planeswalker, remove the creature after it gets cast, things like that. You know, play something with protection, which would be totally fine with me.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that matchup specifically is just the fact that you have pressure backed up by Spell Queller and so many other counter spells for Sorin that you have a lot of ways to prevent that from hitting the battlefield. And, you know, I would imagine if Vein Ripper is into play, it's probably kind of lights out. There's not really a lot of answers to Ripper, but you have enough ways to stop it, that to stop it from coming into play, that I think it should be fine.
Yeah, Ripper is hard, but I think the other reason why Vampires is so good is because that curve of turn one Thoughtseize or a turn one Fatal Push, depending on who's on the play, followed by a turn two Blood Tithe Harvester, followed by turn three Sorin to do anything. Like, Sorin into Vein Ripper is the best. I think Sorin into Archfiend of, or you can't Sorin Archfiend of the Draws Out, but Sorin into Preacher of the Schism, I think is also a really good play, that if they're just like a half step ahead of you or setting the terms of the game and the interaction, they'll usually outvalue you on card quality. So being able to kind of like pick and choose where you're trading those resources, I think is so critical, because eventually they're going to either land a Ripper or an Archfiend or a Preacher that's going to run away with the game.
My concern, and I think like the deck that has to be able to do this, right, is like, how do you operate at flash speed if you are trying to stall your opponent, right? Because like you said, Stan, like, especially if like you're on the draw or something, is as spirits, is how are you setting up anything that is putting your opponent at risk while you're just sort of sitting back on counter magic or sitting back on a spell queller or something like that. So you have to be able to do something at the end of their turn if they're not casting anything at sorcery speed. And I think Spirits has the ability to do that.
Yes. That's the thing. That's the big thing about that deck is Rattle Chains helps you through that particular conundrum.
Yeah, and also Mausoleum Wonder. And also I think what Spirits does, interestingly, even though I don't know how we got into Spirits talk, but like Invasion of Gobekin is a card whose estimation for me has improved over the months. I think I once even asked Devin, maybe it was off mic, like, is Invasion of Gobekin actually that good? And Devin, you said it's very good. And that's true, because you can play it on turn two and it's not actual Thoughtseize, but you get a lot of information about what they have in hand. You can sort of shape your game plan around that, while also slowing down whatever their turn two or turn three play is, and start to build a little bit of artificial tempo that way as well.
Sure feels like a Thoughtseize against Vein Ripper.
Yeah, right.
Good luck casting that one.
Yeah.
So how do we want to draw a line under Vampires? We got some Vampires content here.
It's very good.
Other places. Vampires is very good, right?
It's really good. Have a plan.
It's the best mid-range deck.
Is it setting the standard in this format right now? I mean, it looks like it has to be, right? It's the biggest meta. It's probably one of the most successful decks. Everything revolves around this, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it has like one bad matchup and one kind of like below mid matchup, which is where you want to be.
And one thing to note, very importantly about Vampires, normally under normal circumstances, the way that you would attack mid-range decks is you would say play more 4-drops, more 5-drops, more late game cards. But the thing is that you have to realize if you load up too much on those, then they're just going to go turn 3 Ripper you, and your, you know, 4 and 5 mana grindy card is not going to even come close to mattering at all. So keep that in mind when you're sideboarding against this deck.
All right, Izzy Phoenix up next. Frank has it at 14.2% of the winner's meta. This is a fine deck. It's like, you know, Annihil has it like at 52.7%, and actually it's the most, this is telling. It has the most naturally high meta representation at like 16.6% of the meta, but you know, Frank has it at, you know, lower in kind of the overall winner's meta. Rakdos Vampires is, you know, 21.5 compared to this. So Vampires is performing much better than Izzet Phoenix is right now. And when you look at the win rate matchup, you kind of quickly see why, because it does not have anywhere near as much of a, you know, clean fight or clean winning fights against a bunch of different decks. Like, it has, you know, it's sub 50 against two of the three top decks, or in terms of representation. It's below 50 against Rakdos Vampires. It's below 50 against the Malia combo. If you want to go further down the things, of course, it has its historically bad matchup against Lotus Field. but also struggles against the two Boros aggressive decks, right? In Heroic and Convoke. And so,
which is weird because of how much creature removal there is in this deck. I'm right? a little surprised. There's a lot of X2s in the Heroic deck in particular. I'm kind of surprised that it struggles.
I mean, I'm guessing just like, but the protection spells in Heroic and
of course,
the go wide nature of Convoke.
Yeah. But then you have counter. I don't know. I'm surprised, I guess I would say. But
yeah, I mean, it's there's not a lot to say, right? Like, there's a lot of strengths, there's a lot of weaknesses. I don't know if the weaknesses are something that you can particularly, you know, shore up right now or want to swallow that pill. But what are your thoughts about, you know, Phoenix right now, Devin?
I mean, you know, it's what the way that I look at Phoenix, it's basically the Jund of the format, right? You're never going to get to, you're going to have maybe one or two polarized matchups where you have, you know, very like, I'm trying to think of a good example, like Jund versus Tron traditionally was a really, you know, unfavorable. That's, you know, big mana against the mid-range deck, which mm-hmm. is Lotus Field against Phoenix. That's kind of what that is. And then you have like your really good matchup against the low to the ground aggressive deck. But then past that, it's just a bunch of 50-50s. And that's kind of where Phoenix is. Like Shane said, there's really not a lot to talk about here. You know, you can sideboard aggressively against Lotus Field, but honestly, I would caution against that because even the people who have been sideboarding aggressively, you just don't like that just doesn't materialize all that much because you end up in a spot where you can't clock them fast enough. And your sideboard card is like a 3-mana Ashiok, which you tap out for and maybe still just end up dying that turn. So, you know, you got to be a little bit careful about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and we're in a world where like Lotus Field combo is not particularly super high representation. So I think you just have to, you know, take those lumps, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can always play play a tournament where you're just like, I hope the dodge deck X. And sometimes you do.
Yeah. Now, is this deck about to get worse because of High Noon, or are there not that many decks that are really going to run High Noon?
I would say if your deck had Deafening Silence in it before, there is, and you have red mana, there is a chance that you want to consider swapping out Deafening Silence for High Noon, but it's not one of those things where you're just going to aggressively like play. You're not going to splash a High Noon in your red aggressive deck or something. Like, right. You would have splashed Deafening Silence if you wanted that effect.
Right.
So, you know, it's not, I don't think it's going to affect that dynamic too much.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like High Noon is a brand new effect to the entire format, right? It's just like a newer, potentially better upgrade kind of card.
It's just better because of the fact that it's non-creature versus, you know, what Deafening Silence said, and then it has the bailout on it too to turn it into a 5 damage if you want. Kill your Shieldred if you want. Now, Stan, you said that you had a personal reason you were not going
to
play Phoenix.
I need to know this.
You know, we kind of come into the consensus that like Phoenix is kind of pretty middle right now. It's kind of the Jund of the format, Devin said. Why are you not interested in Phoenix right now?
It's boring.
Okay.
It's boring. So
it's taken 6 years almost on the podcast for you to admit that Phoenix is boring.
I think it's okay for a deck to kind of do the same thing every time. Like, we've had this conversation about other formats in the past. Like, you know, it's one of the things that I love about Rhinos is you can play a very consistent strategy. Mm-hmm. What Phoenix does that is boring for me personally is that the thing you keep doing is just casting cantrips and drawing cards. And that doesn't actually do anything. And it's so fun to spin the wheels. It's fun tapping your mana, drawing cards, seeing other cards. You can draw another card draw with your card draw. Like, I think that's a blast to a certain extent. But just doing that for extended periods of time, like, isn't stimulating for me.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, it's a deck I love to have and will kind of pick up from time to time, but I just need something that offers a little bit more variety in its play patterns and not like, do I put this land on the bottom with an opt or do I draw the land with my opt? And that's just what so many of the decisions come down to when you're playing Phoenix.
Yeah, the people that love to play Phoenix are the people who like maybe tank for about 30 seconds in their first opening hand, and then their turn one play is Spire, Bluff, Go, and then the end of turn consider takes about at least 2 minutes to resolve. So,
those are the people who love
Phoenix. I've been there. That used to be me, and like I have no ill will to those players. No longer find it stimulating.
I was going
to
say, I feel like 2024 Stan is a different beast than what we've had in the past. This is a man who played Blue Moon for a long time. in modern, that's back right. when we started the podcast. So interesting. Okay. Yeah, well, I guess we don't have to dwell on Phoenix too much. Given all this, it's good deck. It's the second deck in the format. People are going to play it because they love it. There's probably not new cards coming for it, but we don't particularly love it as a pick for this RCQ season. Yeah.
Maybe it's the best control deck in the format.
Yeah.
For our next deck, perhaps we can talk about Amalia Combo, which, according to Frank, is the third most popular deck among the winners metagame, and it's got two up arrows. I think this is a deck that had a really big breakout at RC Atlanta last year, kind of went down afterward. And then whenever we see high level Pioneer paper play, it always sort of like proves itself all over again.
Yes. That's what's wild about this deck, right? Is like, you know, Anil has it at 52.8% win rate. And you look at the matchup spread and broadly, you're good. You know, besides Azorius Control, which is bad, everything else is, you know, quite winnable to good. Besides, like, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about the sort of like mono black mid range, like Waste Knot style deck, which is not good against it, but it's not good against. But largely, this deck is surprisingly consistent, apparently.
Yeah, looking at the MTG decks, just to kind of bounce off of that. Azorius Control is at 29. That's like of the 10 top 10 decks, it's the only, you know, sub 50. And then you have 72 against Lotus, 58 against Rakdos mid-range. I don't know why they, even though why that's still on there. But yeah, everything else is about 50-50. And if any, if you take a 50-50 with a deck that has a turn three kill like that, you can't be in that bad of a spot with that setup.
Mm-hmm. I think what makes this so good against something like Phoenix, which is full of creature removal, and this is a creature combo deck, is that it forces you to interact both with the board and the graveyard because they just have like such great recursion tools to kind of like laugh in your face after you spent a ton of cards picking off their creatures one by one. And then they'll just like Coco and win on the spot. They'll return to the ranks and like blank all, like kind of negate all of your removal spells before that anyway. So I think we've been seeing Phoenix decks play Ashiok main, and like obviously that's really good for the mirror. I think that's also like secretly quite good for Amalia combo or against them.
Yeah, I've been surprised at this deck's, you know, seeming longevity so far, that it wasn't just a flash in the pan.
All right, so that's the end of tier one. So here's the thing. Tier one in this Pioneer meta breakdown, 21% Rakdos Vampires, 14.2% is it Phoenix, 13.4% Amalia combo. There's a huge drop off in Frank's particular weighting of the metagame from tier one to tier two. And this is also where things get weird in my estimation. I feel like I stopped paying attention to Pioneer for like 3 weeks. And now this second tier is just what? It's kind of all over the place. Yeah. What are these decks? So the first deck in this tier, I'll just mention it, is listed here as Waste Knot. Mm-hmm. And Anil Yahi, I believe, called it mono black midrange. It's what they called it in his posts. I'm not super familiar with this deck. It looks like it has Waste Knot in it. Yeah. What else is here?
Yeah, I don't think we've talked about this deck on the pod yet, or if we did, not at length.
No.
But it, to me, it looks like mono black control, okay, where it's pairing a bunch of hand disruption and removal spells with like some grindy cards like Liliana the Veil to just kind of keep your opponent locked out from doing things, but not actually locked out from performing game actions. And then you eventually win with just like either a Waste Knot that like turns all of your discard spells into threats or card advantage, or you play a Shieldred that the Shieldred stuff, or you play an Alklazatz, which I'm sure also does Alklazatz stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or Reckoner Bankbuster if you just want to like do it the old-fashioned way now.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason why this deck has been popping up a lot more, if you look at the challenge results and things like that, is because it actually, I think, well, I mean, funny enough, looking at Anil Yahi's data, only boasts a 43% against Phoenix. But the list that I'm looking at from Frank's list has four copies. Yes, you heard that right. Four copies of main deck Go Blank. Which, you know, that's if Phoenix is everywhere, that's a pretty good place to be. And on top of that, you have the Lilianas and the Shieldred's Edicts to be able to edict a Vein Ripper without having to pay that ward cost. So I do think this deck, you know, as much as I've made fun of it in the past, because I think it's, I thought it was kind of a joke before, it actually has kind of gotten to the point where the metagame, I think, is kind of perfect for it. And I think this deck's okay.
I mean, Goblink's probably okay against Amalia too, right? You can kill their creatures, make them sacrifice creatures, and also get rid of stuff out of their graveyard. So maybe it's not a great matchup, but that seems reasonable. So interesting thing to look out for. Shall we go on to the next one?
Yeah, this is the one that I found most puzzling. Nivtalite.
Number five, Nivtalite, 5.3%.
We're always going to get new gold cards, I guess.
Yeah.
What is Niv? Is this just like a big control deck? Like, is that really all it's doing?
Niv is mid-range, you generally speaking, right? It's like like getting yourself...
Big range?
Kind of big mid-range, right? It's trying to get you into a situation where you can maximize card advantage, essentially, off of your Niv.
I mean, this is basically like if you want to kind of get into the weeds a little bit, this is essentially what Omnath was before Beanstalk was banned.
Right.
Okay. Right. This deck is playing Beanstalk and Omnath, and it's also playing Binding and Bring the Light. So it kind of is fulfilling that role where it's like mid-range deck has the capability of playing a long game with a lot of card advantage. But ideally, it's like trying to fulfill that, you know, lot of removal spells, big finisher kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a based on the data. It looks like it's mostly kind of a meta counter to Rakdos Vampires, which it has like a good matchup against. It's, of course, good against kind of general other quote-unquote mid-range strategies and control decks, but still seems to have the same rougher matchups against more aggressive decks in the format. And so, you know, I think it's for people who like playing the style of deck, but, you know, if the room is going to be, you know, 20%, 25% Rakdos Vampires, that seems like a bit of a stretch, but, you know, maybe it's just like kind of your pick. You're like, well, you know, maybe I can figure out my aggressive matchups and just roll the other mid-range and control strategies in the room.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to Stan's point earlier about, you know, metagaming and picking a deck specifically for a tournament. Like, if you show up and what Shane was saying and you expect, 25 to 30% of the room is going to be Rakdos and there's not going to be Lotus Field, Niv's a pretty good choice. And I think that in smaller scale events, specifically like RCQs, where the field is much smaller and you maybe have, you know, it's maybe more local people that you're familiar with and maybe you know their play, what they're playing and what they usually play, then it could be a better call to play something like Niv.
Yeah. Hopefully, if you're registering Niv, you're not facing a ton of Phoenix decks because that sounds like a tough matchup.
Also worth
soul too.
Yeah. Also worth mentioning that I don't think we did, but this is also has Yorion in it. So it's this, at least Frank's example list is an 80 card Niv.
That card's legal.
I sometimes forget myself. All right. Next on the list, Azorius Control, 4.5%. Has downward trend according to Frank. However, you know, this deck was popular a couple of weeks ago and now it's on its way down.
That's what's crazy.
Times change.
This is the first deck on our list that has down arrows next to it. And it was not that long ago that Doom was telling me that this is the deck to play. It's the best deck in the format.
Doom is napping, by the way.
Devin does not want to talk about Blue Eye Control. It is pretty boring in Pioneer.
I mean, it's good to talk about how fast it's fallen.
It's as Blue Eye Control as you can. Like, I feel like this is the avatar of a Blue Eye Control deck in some ways. You know what I mean? Like, it just is.
Even more so than in Modern. At least in Modern, they kill you with Solitudes.
Right.
Like in Pioneer, they literally kill you with Teferi, Hero of Dominaria. It's like, it's about as Blue Eye Control as you can Blue Eye Control, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's lost my fair share of Shark tokens and Seed Chrome Shark tokens, too.
Lovely.
Yeah, anyway, I love losing like that. It's perfect. It makes me happy. Shake hands, move on.
Why'd it fall so fast? It's not good against vampires. Oh, it's terrible against vampires.
It's terrible against, bad against Phoenix, bad against vampires, and bad against aggressive decks like Ensoul Spirits. Ensoul, the Spirits decks, the two Boros decks. I mean, what's appealing if once the data has sort of borne itself out, you know?
This deck has one good matchup, and it's just Amalia.
I was going to say, right?
And I think that when that kind of resurgence in Amalia or that, you know, popularity increase in Amalia happened, that's when a lot of people started playing blue white. But as soon as the PT happened with vampires, like vampires just kind of dumps on this deck. So,
all right, that's it.
You know, the next deck also has some down arrows.
Yes.
Lotus Combo. And I think this is another one that's a little bit of a surprise, because Lotus Combo is often the deck you turn to if you want to beat up on Phoenix. We talk about Phoenix being, you know, the second most popular deck in the format. I would think that Lotus would almost exist there too. Like, if Azorius control is going down, Lotus doesn't have as many maybe predators in the format one might expect, and it gets to eat up on all Phoenix lunches. But it seems like that's not been the case.
Yeah, you know what's funny to me about kind of specifically the Lotus Field against Rakdos Vampires, which, spoiler alert, is not that great for Lotus Field. It's 33% according to Anil Yahi's data. And I think there's kind of just been this trajectory in terms of that matchup specifically. Like, for example, before Smuggler's Copter was printed, it was Rakdos Midrange. And I think, traditionally speaking, that was a tougher matchup for Rakdos Mid because they just didn't have a fast enough clock. And then the printing of Smuggler's Copter happened, kind of swayed the matchup a little bit more towards Rakdos's favor. And now with the introduction of Sorin Veinripper, like, if you go turn 2 Blood Tithe, turn 3 Sorin Veinripper, that is a turn 4 kill, right? You attack for 3. You pump up the Blood Tithe, attack for 3, next turn, attack with both, sack the Veinripper, and that's just, you have enough damage. So that, like, more consistent turn 4 kill is really something that Lotus Field does not want, because when they're on the draw, they need that extra turn.
Interesting. It's also a tough deck to pick up. Like, I feel like this is going to be the hardest sell for people to be like, here, come learn, like, the complex lines of tapping and untapping your lands with your cyclers.
Well, the tap untap lands is maybe for a different episode, but
yeah, with cards that don't go into any other deck as well. All right, let's talk about the first deck that I like and am actually likely to play on Saturday. Can we talk about Izzet and Sol?
Of course, because I know that this is the deck you're going to play, buddy.
It's yeah, you know he's going to play. Stan, what is it about Insol over the spoilers? Typically better and historically better decks like the Boros decks,
because Boros decks don't run Dark Steel Citadel. What are you supposed to do against an indestructible 5/5, Shane? There's nothing to do. You can't do
literally
anything.
Nothing.
There's nothing you can do. Boros decks also don't run counter spells, and like, I'd love to get them with a cheeky spell pierce.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest, that it doesn't have anything to do with Dark Steel Citadel. Mana. It's blue mana. Yeah,
that's part of it.
I like the Insol decks a lot. I haven't had the opportunity to play them a lot, but I do quite like them. There were some lists over the weekend. I kind of lean towards specifically the ones without Bushwhacker and Gleeful Demolition. I'm not a huge fan of those versions.
Oh, they're gone.
I kind of like the more just like Stubbs, Insols, big dudes, that kind of stuff. But I think the deck is reasonably well positioned.
I think if you've been paying attention to the MTGO results, like, it's been popping up in a lot of high finishes. It's winning challenges. It's reaching the finals. It's putting up a lot of top 8 results.
Here's,
it grinds. Like, I think that's the thing. It has like really explosive games where you just get them on turn 3 when they least expect it. And then sometimes it can actually play like a surprising long game because of some of the new additions it's gotten actually from murders among the cases. And other cards.
Yeah, I'm curious if there is a way to shore up the weak Phoenix and weak Vampires matchups, it's like statistically, because that's not where I would want to be, right?
I haven't figured out Phoenix, but Vampires, there's a couple ways to beat Vampires.
More Darksteel Citadels.
Play eight. Just cheat. Cheat, put more Citadels in there. So we're playing more and more copies of sideboard Akroan War. Mm-hmm. And Akroan War to steal a Veinripper is a big game.
Is that better than Tears of Valakut?
I don't know what that is.
1 in a red, instant, deal 5 to a flyer, can't be countered.
Yes, because the Akroan War lets you take that Veinripper and attack with it too. And it's a blocker.
Mana, though.
It's true.
I feel like if I'm playing that matchup, I would almost rather just kill it for 2 mana than have to wait 2 turns of them having a Ripper, you know what I mean?
Your spell is uncounterable as well?
Yeah, 2 mana uncounterable.
I mean, I think the benefit of a Akroan War is that like you're either stealing a Ripper, maybe you're stealing the Schism Vampire, but it's also actually like clearing their board. So you force them to attack, and if you have like enough dinky 1/1s that you don't really care about to like block them, they're then like actually blowing themselves up, and you have, maybe you don't have a Ripper afterwards, or you do, But then after, like, the Crone War reaches chapter 3, you can probably just swing for lethal, or you've gotten so far ahead of them that you're up on resources. But you're probably right. Like, it's probably not efficient, and we've entered an echo chamber of Ensoul players who are like, a Crone War is the truth. I don't know if I'm going to be the one to change that tide. I'd rather just join them for now.
Sure. That's fair. I would just look for something a little bit cheaper. That's kind of where my head was at.
It's only 50 cents. Like, how cheap can you get for a rare?
Come on.
About that cheap. All right, Stan. So you're going to sleeve up Ensoul this week? Almost definitely.
Yeah, I think I'm sleeving up Ensoul.
All right. Let's round out this top 10 with the last two decks. I'm just going to name them really quick because they're decks that I love, and one of which Stan loves. One is Boros Heroic, 2.5%. And the final out of the top 10 is Azorius Spirits, 2%. We talked a lot about spirits off the top. So maybe we can hold on that for a minute. We've actually talked a lot about Boros Heroic too, but I will say, you know, this is the one that's going to have the new card, or one of the new cards that we think it's going to slot in here the most likely. So I would be looking at this one a little bit to maybe see what happens, just to see if it becomes a trend up, or if it stays the same, or what really happens with that, with Trick Shot, Slick Shot, Show Off.
One final note on Heroic versus Convoke. The Heroic matchup is against Amalia is much, much better than the Convoke matchup because of the presence of those indestructible giving cards. So, you know, if you were looking to be on the Boros side of things, I think I would lean a little bit more towards Heroic because of its, you know, better matchup against Amalia, but just something to keep in mind there.
I also think it doesn't, for what it's worth, Convoke is great and powerful and has those, like, you know, Convoke into the big five drops. It's not as tricky of a deck. Heroic's not as tricky of a deck, I think, as Convoke, or it's not quite as like A plus B kind of combo. It's really just creatures plus spells. So I think its plan is a little bit easier to execute. So I feel like that's part of why it's also trending up as well. Plus, it's gotten a couple of extra cards recently that make it a lot better in, the bear card and such.
I need to contribute three final decks into a serious cool decks Inc. digression, because I think there's three decks that are on the outskirts of the format that have maybe to a certain extent like proven their place as outliers and could actually catch you by surprise if you're not prepared. Quintorious Combo being the biggest of them. Four mana, win the game. One card combo.
It's five mana though. Yeah.
I don't care. Wins the game.
Yeah.
Who cares about one extra piece of mana?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, Stan, you can win the game for three mana by casting Sorin. So.
Yeah, those are in higher demand though. More mirror matches.
Yep. All right. So you have Quint that you wanted to talk about. What else is on your sleeper list? I guess we could call this
Rakdos Transmogrify.
Okay.
Cheating Atraxa into play with like a bunch of stupid token makers like Barbed Batterfist and Case of the Stash Skeleton and Mirex and some better token makers like Fable the Mirrorbreaker and Reckoner Bankbuster.
Perfect.
Okay.
Keep an eye out for that. And then what's your final one?
Five color Scapeshift.
I keep forgetting Scapeshift is legal in Pioneer.
Sure is.
And it's been legal in Pioneer for like a decade now. It's been around for so long.
A decade?
It's not quite that long, but it has been around for a while, for at least 5 years, 4 or 5 years, I think.
Round up, baby.
Yeah. I would prefer not to. I'm 45 years old, so I don't really want to round up numbers.
I will remind you, Pioneer is about 5 years old.
Fair. All right, so this is like what are we killing with this? We don't have Valakut, so what is this? What are we doing? We're untapping things with Spelunking.
We need a whole episode for that.
Do we really? Is it just like bringing a bunch of stuff and then bring to light, or like what's going on here?
Yeah, it's Spelunking, five lands, bring to light, Scapeshift, Lotus Field, Mystic Sanctuary, Dross Pits, Gingerbread Cavern.
Oh my God.
Onward and onward, and then I guess you win with Splendid Reclamation.
Yeah, so the joke is that Lotus Field, all your lands come into play untapped, and Mystic Sanctuary, even though you don't have islands, the joke is that if it comes into play untapped, it triggers, even if you have no other lands. So the joke is you eventually, like, you Lotus Field, sacrifice all your lands, put a Splendid Wreck on top, draw the Splendid Wreck with some land that draws a card, cast Wreck, do it all again, make up infinite mana, basically. And then I think previously the kill condition was Ipni Rivulet, which is just like mill them out a million times when you're going through these Splendid Wreck loops. But I don't know if they've changed their win condition since then.
So watch out for it.
Watch out. We don't know also if they changed their win cons.
Watch out for Barbed Batterfist, apparently, showing up to a Pioneer RCQ near you.
For Mirrodin.
For Mirrodin.
All right. Well, Stan, thank you for taking us through your process. You're thinking about the Pioneer RCQs this weekend. And just a little refresher on the meta for everybody. You're going to be playing in Seoul. Devin, are you playing any of these coming up?
I was planning on playing an RCQ this weekend, but I actually have some NRG commentary to do. So
okay.
I was going to play the blue-black profs deck, which we may discuss in just a minute.
I think I think we're ready to talk about it now. So Devin has nicely, you know, you posted on Twitter the other day that you spent 75 hours brewing decks in Pioneer and something wanted like to share that. Them with Whoa. People. But you had like 20 decks that you were sharing, right? That you had put together that you shared on Twitter and maybe on, did you put a YouTube video up to it?
I have not posted them yet. This time, This time I'm keeping them close to the chest. I don't want to give out all the content at once. But I felt like it would be a good idea to maybe discuss a couple of these to give people a sneak peek to what we're doing.
As a treat.
As a little treat.
For the Dive Down boys. Okay.
Exactly. So the first one here is the Dimir Prof deck. Now, this is one I had kind of showed you the Duels of the Minds that I bought earlier. Those are definitely for this deck. It's a deck that I spent a lot of time on in Standard specifically. Right. And one that people had also begin to spend a little bit of time on in Pioneer. And honestly, the deck is very similar to the Standard deck. Now, for those of you who don't know, Profs is the 2-mana enchantment ETB draw card, and then combat, you get X counters on a creature, where X is the number of extra cards you've drawn. So it pairs very well with stuff like Consider, Opt, Treasure Cruise, which we get to play, which we don't have access to in Standard, and then Ledger Shredder. And then you get better removal, Fatal Push Thoughtseize. But the big card here is the new addition, Duelist of the Mind. Mm-hmm. So the reason this card is so good is there's so many reasons. So first of all, it has evasion and vigilance, which means that when you start putting counters on it with Profs, it plays offense and defense very well, something that Shredder doesn't do.
It's a Sarah Angel.
Right. Two, it triggers off of Fatal Push and Thoughtseize and Bitter Triumph, the loot ability. Whenever you commit a crime, you can loot. And then third, it kind of, when you have it and Profs in play, it kind of gives you this almost double up effect where you're getting power from the Duelist for drawing cards and you're getting power from the Profs to draw cards. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you have Duelist and Profs in play and you draw you cast Treasure Cruise, you're attacking them for 7 damage that turn, even if you've cast nothing else, just the Cruise itself, which is, it just gets out of control really, really quickly. So I'm very, very excited to start with this one. That's going to be the first deck I would want to play.
And so Profs, to me, still constantly looks like a card that is like not doing enough.
Oh, you got to play with it.
And I'm wrong, right? Trust me. Very wrong about that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, like, it is one of those cards that until you really start playing with it, it's hard to like understand and articulate how much it actually does, because you're right, it doesn't do anything when it comes into play. But if you have enough two drops where, you know, the idea being you play a creature on two and then turn three, you go Prof's cantrip, that's where you can like start to get the value out of it. And then once you get an additional untap, it just gets out of control from there.
Yeah. I mean, it cantrips when it comes into play. Yes. So it does something. But
the thing that's surprising to me is that there's no creatures that I can see that sort of take advantage of having 1/1 counters, meaning like it's just value. It's just pure value. And there's something that's like, if it has a counter or remove a counter to do something or like sacrifice it. Yes. Just tapping and attacking seems good enough.
Just get in the red zone.
I mean, they all fly. Or I mean, the yes. smaller ones fly, the larger ones are just value.
Yeah. The way that I look at this deck is what the closest we're going to get to a Delver deck in Pioneer, right? Where it's just like, you know, interact early, play a cheap flying threat, and then just protect it.
Now you're talking my language, though.
Hello. Azoria Spirits would like to chat.
No.
Friend. I mean, that's literally play a one drop and counter spells.
Okay. Yeah, that's days. True. Spirits is pretty know. Close.
I don't know.
What if I told you could play Spirits with Ancestral Recall, though?
Now you're talking.
Okay.
All right. Devin, Dimir Prof sounds cool. good place to start. What else is on your mind?
Well, the next one up, I think you're probably pretty interested in, Dave.
Oh yeah.
This is the Slickshot Show Off. Now, this particular deck list doesn't have a ton of, like, there's really not a lot of new cards here. So, I basically just took the regular Heroic deck. I swapped, as I said earlier, the 10th District Legionnaire for the Slickshot Show Offs. And then there's another new card here that I'm not 100% sure on, but I have heard some people kind of talking about this one. It's Demonic Ruckus.
I'm going to read it for everybody. I wanted to bring this back on our... I was almost going to talk about this on the big spoiler episode last week because we missed it on the spoiler. So Craig from our Discord shared a Boggles Auras list like for Pioneer because of this card. And this card is... It costs a generic and a red. It's an enchant creature, Aura. Enchanted creature gets +1/+1 and has Medicine Trample. When Demonic Ruckus is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, draw a card, and it has plot for a single red. Now, real quick, in an Auras deck, people are imagining taking this, plotting this on turn one, playing Light Paws on turn two, then playing this onto Light Paws and going absolutely ham with potentially a card that's unblockable, can't be targeted if you go get Alpha Authority or doing other things. Now, I don't know if that's really going to happen, but definitely this, I felt bad about not talking about this card because I do think this card is powerful.
Yeah, and I think this might be the only card, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to think of cards, we're not going to go through the whole spoiler set, but I'm trying to think of cards that have a cheaper plot cost than their actual mana cost. And I think this might be the only one that I can recall.
There are some, but I don't remember too many other cards that had plot for a single mana that looked like they actually did anything. Cheap. And this is the thing that this is the reason that I'm annoyed that I missed it in the spoiler episode is because I try to go through and look at things that are a single mana cost is like a part of my process for ingesting a set and just
it's two in the top right though.
Yeah, that's the problem. There wasn't any way for me to figure it out. So you like this card in here too, just because it's a cheap way to kind of get the ball rolling, make sure you can be really aggressive on turn two.
Yeah, and specifically with the way that this deck works, because you have like I'm trying to think of you like the draw that I'm envisioning is like you mentioned, you could plot this on one. And even if you like curving this into plotting Slickshot is like that 1/2 is pretty sick. Cause then you just have turn three, you have two things all ready to go. Maybe you start with like, I don't know, a Swift Spear, play the Show Off for free, play the Ruckus for free, cast another cantrip, have a protection spell up.
Hold
like,
up just God's so willing. Many, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's just so many things that you can like set up with these plot cards. And that's why they're so sick in this deck specifically, because you have those protection spells like the God's Willings. There's Lauren's Escapes, Sajiri Shelters. And the fact that you just get to go plot a Show Off on two and then play it for free, maybe cast two spells and then just have your interactive spell up is really, really sick. So. Yeah, I think Slickshot, this is kind of like the most obvious home for it.
Yeah.
I'm going to work on some prowess decks too, but yeah, this this one, I think if you are looking to play, like if you're looking to play new cards in week one, this is probably a really good place to start.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, last thing on this whole stuff, I don't know if you saw that Andrea Mengucci almost top eighted a tournament that he was at over the weekend with Red Green Prowess and Modern featuring four Slickshot Show Offs as well.
Also, I don't know if you guys saw that this card is like $30.
Slickshot Show Off is $30 already?
There's a $30 version. But the cheapest version is the foil for $11.
Better get lucky with that box foil. My dad is sending me, huh?
Good luck, David.
It's always something.
Yeah, one last thing on specifically Slickshot. I had thought about trying to go to like some kind of double strike thing with like Teemer Battle Rage, Boros Charm. Those are both two mana. So, you know, I wish there was some kind of cheaper way to give double strike. You have Virtuoso, but Slickshot effectively having double prowess means that when you combine that with TBR Boros Charm, you can have some really big turns, especially because the Slickshot is free.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have Assault Strobe.
I wish.
In Pioneer.
Yeah. The more I look at Slickshot and just kind of envision the things you can do with it out of plot, I do have my suspicions this is going to be one of the best rares we've seen in a long time.
Yeah,
it's good.
I mean, we were speculating about what it would take to make a two drop playable in Prowess and Modern, and
we found it.
Yeah, I think this will be, I don't know if that's enough to make the deck actually good in that case. I think it will be pretty good in Pioneer, but you know, we'll see. I literally don't know how they would do more on a 2-mana card, a 2-mana aggressive yes. red card that's not in Modern Horizons, you know. So
yeah, it's pretty bonkers. Devin, I was gonna say, can we talk about this Gerolf deck? Because this takes me back to like the initial things that got me interested in like Modern before I was even really knowing what Modern was about. Besides very expensive Tarmogoyfs and players that were snapping their cards much more quickly than I could in the LGS.
I'm into it. So this is the Azorius kind of Monastery Mentor. The new card here is Gerolf the Fleshrite. So this is the 2/3/4 2 in a blue. Whenever you cast your spell, if it's not the first spell, you make a 2/2 zombie. And then whenever a zombie ETBs, you get a counter on it for each other zombie that entered the battlefield under your control this turn. These specific decks have been popping up a lot in Standard, but they haven't really translated to Pioneer yet. Where now, if you think about it from a Pioneer context, we get better cantrips, right? We get Opt in addition to Consider, and we also get Treasure Cruise. Get slightly better Manix, you get Hallowed Fountain, some additional lands that way, and Henchgate Pathway. But what's really nice about this deck specifically, when you're comparing it to Monastery Mentor, is there's a lot of times when you have these kind of big turns with Monastery Mentor and you make a bunch of 1/1s, but then you have to kind of pass the turn and wait that additional turn and then have another big follow-up to pump your Mentor tokens. What's nice about Gerolf compared to Mentor is if you have that big turn with Gerolf, you get the power bonus because that's just +1/+1 counter. So it just stays there for that next turn.
They're also just bigger tokens. They're 2/2s instead of 1/1s anyway. And so, yeah, that's a big difference right there. And not to mention the fact that one of the problems with any Monastery Mentor deck in the past has been, what happens if I don't draw my Monastery Mentor? And now, you know, this is a rule of eight kind of thing. You have eight things that do that pay you off for your plan. It makes it a lot easier for you. You know, Devin, this list that we haven't talked about the contents of all of these lists, but in this particular one, you know, you have four Helping Hands and two Recommissions. Those are cards that bring back cards that have three or less casting costs for pretty cheap costs. And the super interesting thing about these is that they count as spells for when if you bring Gerolf back with them.
Oh yeah.
Right. So if you recommission Gerolf and then cast on the card, you get the 2/2, even though Gerolf wasn't in play when you play the first spell.
And on that note, the reason I kind of like specifically Jace Reawaken, a lot of people have been talking about Jace in more of kind of a combo context with Valky and things of that nature. But what's really cool about Jace with just the Monastery Mentors like Gerolf and Mentor is you can plot one of those and then next turn you can play it for free and then just go completely ham. And I don't know if that's necessarily like a spot, you know, it is still a little bit slow because you can't cast it in your first three turns. So you're not doing the thing until turn five. But if you can, you know, buy a little bit of time in the first couple of turns, then Jace like really lets you go off specifically with Mentor.
Interesting.
Nice. Yeah. One thing to note about this deck is I probably should have, I kind of forgot this. I don't know why I forgot this in the deck list, but I should have some Picklock Pranksters. Mm. Whereas that card is being a spell, mills four over, finds you the Helping Hand to get back the Mentors. So that card's really good in a deck like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. You got a last one that you are willing to share with the people as an appetizer?
Let's do, you want to do the next one? We'll do Mono Black. Mono Black. Mono Black Bronco. So this one's pretty straightforward. A lot of people have been trying Mono Black. It was one of the most dominant decks in Pioneer, right? I'm sure you guys remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe the listeners at home will do. Where, you know, funny enough, before Copter was banned, and then after Copter was unbanned, people tried it, but there wasn't a ton there. Caustic Bronco, this is kind of like the new Dark Confidant. So just to kind of give you the text again, it's 2/2 for 2. When it attacks, reveal the top card. If it's not settled, you lose life. If it is settled, they lose life to the mana value, and then its settle cost is 3. The saddle is a bit tough in a deck like this. Like if you look at the decks list, it's really just Scrap Heap and Tenacious Underdog. And then I guess the two Karavex. But it doesn't really, you don't need to saddle it because if your curve is low enough in the black deck, then you just have, you know, you're not taking that much damage off of the Bronco and you're just drawing extra cards with it. So
you don't care. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if it's necessarily going to be enough to bring Mono Black back, but if there's anything, like the card does read kind of powerful to me.
I am interested in this.
Yeah.
Your deck has eight non-creature spells, not including Smug Ghost Copter, four Fatal Push, four Thoughtseize. Like, is that enough for a card like Caustic Bronco to, like, not die in every combat?
Maybe not. Maybe you need to play it with more removal spells. I kind of wanted to go the more aggressive approach where you just max out, like, lower the curve as much as humanly possible. And maybe there needs to be more ways to get Caustic Bronco through. Like, you know, you don't want to be attacking and then just kind of binning it. So, yeah, that could be something to think about.
Oh, wait. I will say, though, if you play a 2-drop, attack with it, and it draws you a card, and they choose to block it,
yeah, it kind of replaced itself.
That's not the worst thing in the world, right? Like, it's not great, but yeah. I don't know. I mean, this was one of the saddle cards that we talked about on our spoiler episode, and I was kind of like, mostly I was just saying, look how dirty they did Dark Confidant, basically, because this card is just way more text than Dark Confidant has on it. Yeah, I think it's interesting to see it end up in this shell, definitely.
Made sense to me.
How about Karavik? Are you thinking Karavik is worth, like, is this a fun of, try it out, or do you think this is, like, a real thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I think this card is so weird to me because it works very, very well with cheap black cards, but it itself is a 3-drop, right? So it's like you don't want to go super, like, you can't really play a bunch more expensive cards. A lot of the best ways to commit crimes past Fatal Push and Thoughtseize are like Graveyard Trespasser, Unlicensed Hearse, kind of more expensive cards. And I don't really know how many, like, Karavik is good with cheap cards, but also crimes are mostly, after Push Thoughtseize, are good with maybe more expensive cards. So it's like, the card I think is powerful, specifically with exactly Push Thoughtseize. Like, that's where it seems completely absurd to me. Like, you just go Fatal Push their guy. Upon resolution, the push is in the graveyard. You can just
do it again.
Yeah. You know, like that sequence seems so insane to me.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it only works with black cards. So, like, where else would you play it other than a deck full of black cards? So,
oh, actually, my apologies. You can't do the same Fatal Push. You have to have another one in the graveyard, but because the committing a crime
it's
triggers
the
before the push resolves. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's okay. Like, it still just seems really, really good to me.
Yeah, I mean, it seems better post-board in this deck where you're upping the amount of removal that you have. You might have extra duresses and stuff like that. So there's more effects that you would, you know, there's more spells, like Stan said, pointed out that you can interact with.
Liliana of the Veil is another good one that does trigger crimes because it targets a player.
Right.
But again, more 3-mana cards, like it's good with Trespasser, stuff like that. But I don't want to play too many 3s.
Yeah, well.
Keep the curve low.
Any other ones you want to throw out here, or you want to keep the rest for another time?
Let's do one more, okay?
Okay.
We got time for one spicy one. I had two spicy ones here, but we'll only do the Bant Plot one.
Let's hear it. Bant Plot. Right.
Bant Plot. I bet you didn't see that one coming. First and foremost, shout out to Yeoman5 on Twitter for the inspiration for this one. He had posted a kind of a pioneer list. I took his idea, which was basically, so here's the concept. So we had talked about Jace Valky earlier, right? So you have Jace, which can plot a Valky. Kellen Joins Up is the other addition here to help us kind of, like you said, rule of eight, get more cards that can plot cards from our hand, which Kellen Joins Up is blue, white, green, ETB, exile a card with mana value 3 or less, plot it. So you have 8 ways to plot a Valky. You have Valky. The other 2-mana card that we're plotting here is Bramble Familiar, which, if you're not familiar with this card, the 7-mana sorcery half is mill 7, then put a creature, enchantment, or land from among the milled cards onto the battlefield. So if you plot a Bramble Familiar, you cast the 7-mana sorcery half for free, you can get either Ulamog or Omniscience. So you
that
have
great. That seem combo like it aspect be legal. As well.
Great. Lovely.
And then on top, and then basically the rest of the deck is just a lot of control elements like Get Lost, Number Lies, Supreme Verdict. This one's a bit out there. But, you know, I don't know. It's like you have the combo with good control elements, Get Lost, Normalize, Supreme Verdict. So maybe there's something here.
Yeah, it's like there's basically 0% chance this is the right build. But like this is like a fun core to mess with and like see what's not working, what you have too many copies of, what you need more of, what kind of support you need, and then go from there.
I just like Ulamogging people, you know.
How could you put this kind of energy out in the world, Devin? I don't know.
It's Yeoman who did it, so don't blame me.
Yeah. Excellent brewer. Like if you're on Twitter, Magic Twitter, and you don't look at Yeoman, I imagine everybody who listens to this show probably knows who who they are, but
definitely follow Yo Man.
Yep.
That's all I got.
Bant Plot was my favorite side character from one of the Star Wars novelizations I read as a tween. Bant
Plot. It's good. It's good.
Cool. Thanks for sharing those, Devin. Thanks for leaking some early tech.
Leaked.
But no, this is...
Sorry, I'll be playing them... I'll be playing most of them on stream over the next
couple weeks. When does the set actually drop? Is it like another... Yeah, tomorrow. One of those things where it's like, of course, the day after we need to record our podcast. Yeah.
It's all right. Next week we'll have data.
So. Great. I'll have to be streaming you tomorrow. See how this stuff goes.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited.
Well, I feel ready to compete and crush. I don't know where the RC is or if I'm... free that day.
Oh, meaning like the actual, the RC itself. I was like, Stan, I hope you know where the RCQ is.
Yeah, what I'm competing for.
But let's not put the cart before the horse, buddy.
I like to book my flight to the RC before I register for any RCQ.
It puts the appropriate amount of pressure on you to do well.
It ensures I always get a guaranteed seat.
Yeah.
In that vein, I should probably book a flight. I should probably get my passport because if I do well at the RC in Dallas, I'm going to go to Amsterdam, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't have a passport, you should do that soon need to have one renewed. Took me 6 weeks recently to get a new one, so I would keep that in mind. Travel tips, you come to the Dive Down for those. Stan, and with that,
get your passport, drink loads of water, Cliff Bars. That's the Dive Down.
Caffeinated cliff bars.
They're illegal
cliff
now.
Bar, get at us.
They took them off the market.
They did not.
I think they did. I haven't seen one in years.
Are they Cliff Bars that kill you? Is that why?
Yeah. If you drink them with enough alcohol. Ooh.
Or the right lemonade.
Right.
That lemonade rules, by the way. Have you had this Panera charged lemonade?
No.
Why would I step foot into a Panera? I'm not like an octogenarian.
My children love Panera. They have a song that they sing about it.
What's the song go like?
They love it. They just go, Panera bread, whenever we get it.
Like me when I go to Quiznos.
Yeah.
Shane, you're telling me you've never had a bowl of soup, but the bowl was a piece of bread?
I mean, not in the last 15 years.
Well, you should try it. Bread makes the best bowls.
They got reasonable pizza.
That's my favorite kind of pizza.
Believe it reasonable. Or not, reasonable pizza for kids. That makes everybody in the house happy.
I'm telling you, this blood orange charged lemonade is what's up. It's what this podcast is built on secretly.
Oh my God. I'm trying to kick like caffeine and junk food and a lot of things right now. So we need to end this podcast before I scream at you guys. Okay.
I had a churros flavored Oreo, David. It was good.
God. Oh, I'm on Weight Watchers right now. It's not
Weight Watchers, get at us.
It's not looking good over here.
Dub dub.
And that wraps up this week's show. If you haven't yet, make sure you subscribe to our podcast and get the latest episodes as soon as they come out. And if you use Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please leave us a rating and review. If you'd like to submit a question to the podcast or just reach out in general, you can tweet us at the Dive Down, all one word, or email thedivedown@gmail.com. If you'd like to support our show, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/thedivedown. You can check out our store, thedivedown.com/store. We're e-commerce now. If you want to support Doomwake, you can do that over at twitch.tv/D00MWAKE. It's above his head. The O's are zeros, though. I can't believe I have to keep telling you people. You can head over to heavyplay.com to get some incredible deck and dice boxes and playmats featuring the EquipMax system. And if you use promo code THEDIVEDOWN2024, you'll get 10% off your first order at Heavy Play. Shout out to Mana Traders for sponsoring the Dive Down. If you sign up for Mana Traders using promo code THEDIVEDOWN_K4L, that's one word, and that gets you 10% off your first 2 months of renting Magic Online cards. As always, special thanks to the bands Nowhere and Spaceblood for letting us use their music. And until next week, get out there and get good cards from your OTJ booster pack. Shane, before you kill me, should we talk about Balatro for 5 minutes?
No.
No.